Welcome to Expert Second Opinion. Investigators provide perspectives on the best practice management of ovarian cancer. I'm Dr. Shannon Weston, and I'll be moderating our meeting today. And these are our very esteemed faculty to my right. Dr. Nicoletta Colombo, Dr. Gottfried Konechny, and Dr. Alexander Oluwaye. You have the best of the best here, and I hope you're going to enjoy it. These are relevant faculty conflicts of interest. You can review them at your leisure. Takes a second to get through them, though, doesn't it? These people are very important. And here's the commercial support for today. The Research to Practice CME Planning Committee, staff, and reviewers have no COIs to disclose. This program will contain discussion of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. Please refer to official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. So let's get started. In order to make this meeting more relevant for our participants, Dr. Love conducted video interviews with Professor Jonathan Letterman, Dr. Ursula Matulonis, and Dr. Angela Secord, during which they presented cases from their practice. Excerpts from these interviews will be shown throughout the program, and our esteemed faculty will provide a second opinion. So this is where we're headed today. Dr. Colombo will begin with PARP inhibitors. I'll be talking about folate receptor alpha. Dr. Oluwaye will discuss other novel agents. And then Dr. Konechny will finish us off with management of adverse events. And my faculty are accepting of first names, so we'll move from there. So with no further ado, I would love to invite Dr. Colombo, Nicoletta, to the stage.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Shannon, for the kind introduction. So in the next 8-10 minutes, I will review the current role of PARP inhibitor in advanced ovarian cancer, particularly focusing on the frontline setting. This is the incredible evolution of first-line chemotherapy and maintenance for advanced ovarian cancer during the last 30 years. We actually were kind of stuck for quite a while with carboplatin and paclitaxel. And finally, a small light appears in 2011 with bevacizumab. And the big tsunami, what I call tsunami, occurred in starting from 2018 with the solo one study. And then all the other studies indicated the incredible activity of PARP inhibitors in ovarian cancer. Why? Because, of course, it was recognized this beautiful mechanism of the synthetic lethality. So basically, you take advantage of a defect which is present in the tumor, you block the repair of the single-strand breaks, and then this will lead to the replication fork collapse, causing increase in double-strand breaks, which will be repaired in normal cells, but will not be repaired when there is a deficiency in the homologous recombination repair mechanism. And what it was very important was to recognize that at least 50% of ovarian cancer, high-grade serous ovarian cancer, have this deficiency in homologous recombination repair. And so this was recognized as a target. But the other question was how to detect HRD, because it was quite clear that the best way was not to look at the cause of homologous recombination deficiency, that is, the mutation of the genes which are involved in the pathway of the homologous recombination, but it was more effective to look at the effect of HRD, which is the genomic instability. So HRD causes this genomic instability, which can be detected through several tests. And most of them, the most important of them, they check in the tumor the presence of BRCA mutation, and also they look at these three parameters to indicate the presence of a high genomic instability. So that's what we should do what I believe we should do in our patients with ovarian cancer to test the tumor, and because at the same time you will address the presence of BRCA mutation, germline and somatic, the presence of mutation in other genes, but also the genomic instability. And why this is important? Why to test for BRCA and HRD? Because we have now several evidences that these both HRD and BRCA mutation are predictive of the efficacy of PARP inhibitors. These are the four more important studies, SOLO 1, PRIMA, ATHENA, and PAOLA 1. All of them demonstrated in patients with BRCA mutation that the use of a PARP inhibitor, olaparib, niraparib, rucaparib, or the combination of olaparib and bevacizumab, the use as a maintenance of these drugs may lead to an incredible improvement in progression-free survival. The same is true for patients whose tumor has a HRD deficiency. So this is when you have a positive HRD test, you see that the addition of niraparib or rucaparib in the maintenance setting or PAOLA-1, so olaparib and bevacizumab, can again lead to a very important improvement in progression-free survival. Now, this is not the end of the story. There are also other trials ongoing. For instance, this is the mono OLA-1 study, which is looking in patients with BRCA wild-type tumor. They are randomized to receive olaparib for 2 years or placebo, and the primary endpoint is progression-free survival. Also, there is another important NRG study ongoing, GY036, which is addressing the duration, the optimal duration of olaparib. These are patients with BRCA mutation or HRD-positive tumor, and they're randomized to receive the 2 years of olaparib, with or without bevacizumab, or just 1 year. That's a very, very important question that we have to address. But the most important question that we have not answered yet is to BEV or not to BEV. So to add BEV or not to our PARP inhibitor in frontline. So what do we know until now? This is an indirect, population-adjusted indirect comparison of patients in PAOLA-1 and in SOLO-1. And as you can see, it looks like the addition of bevacizumab may lead to at least an additive benefit. But this, again, is just an indirect comparison. Similarly, in this other paper, you will see this indirect treatment comparison using the propensity score weighting. And this showed a greater benefit in progression-free survival with the addition of olaparib and bevacizumab in the HRD-positive population compared in the PAOLA-1 compared to niraparib in the PRIMA patient. Again, this is something, but it's not a prospective randomized study, but it is at least some evidence. But in the real life, what can we do, or what I do? I mean, in order to decide whether to use a PARP inhibitor alone or to add bevacizumab, I think there are several factors that we may consider. First of all, overall survival. As you know, we do have positive overall survival data for the SOLO-1. SOLO-1 was a trial in patients with BRCA mutation only. And here you see the 7-year follow-up overall survival data showing a benefit also in overall survival, not only in progression-free survival, with the use of olaparib for 2 years as a maintenance. But also in the PAOLA-1, you have a benefit in overall survival in the BRCA mutated population. What is also very interesting is the subgroup analysis of PAOLA-1, where you have a positive overall survival, so an improvement in overall survival, also for the HRD-positive population. And this was, I would say, almost unexpected, but of course was nice to see that you finally can improve overall survival in the frontline setting, which is something very difficult to achieve. And in fact, in the PRIMA study with niraparib, you know, the PRIMA study looked at the use of maintenance with niraparib for 3 years, Unfortunately, you don't see any benefit in overall survival. And this is true for the overall population, for the HRD positive, and even for the BRCA mutated population. So that was really disappointing and quite, at this point, unexpected, given the results of Paula 1. So we may decide to look at the overall survival data and say, okay, I want to go for the combination because I can achieve a better overall survival. The other consideration may be you can look at the clinical risk of the patient. So if we have a patient at higher risk, which means stage 4, stage 3 with residual tumor or undergoing neoadjuvant chemo, maybe bevacizumab can be more beneficial in this setting. But actually, again, if you look at this subgroup analysis, the Paula one, and you look at the lower risk, which are the patients without residual tumor, stage 3 without residual tumor, you see that the use of olaparib and bevacizumab provides an incredible progression-free survival. So it's difficult to decide based on this. So for me, the most important consideration is the response to chemotherapy. Why? Because we know that response to platinum is predictive of response to PARP inhibitor. So in patients with measurable disease or undergoing neoadjuvant chemo, you can measure the response after 3 cycles and with the Kalim score, with the CRS, with other measures. And then, in case you don't see a very good response, you add bevacizumab. I add bevacizumab in these patients. And then, if HRD positive, olaparib in the maintenance phase. But if you have a very, very good response to platinum, you may avoid the use of bevacizumab, just go with maintenance with a PARP inhibitor. Of course, the last consideration is about toxicity. You know that the different PARP inhibitors have different toxicity profile. Some of them are similar, but some of them are different. For instance, the thrombocytopenia with niraparib. And of course, if you use Bev plus olaparib, you will have also the hypertension related to bevacizumab. And you have to consider the contraindication. So the final answer will come from randomized studies, and we do have ongoing randomized studies looking at the question niraparib plus Bev versus niraparib. There are 2 of them are phase 3, the Nirvana and the AGO over 28, and finally they will give us the answer whether it's important to add bevacizumab or not. So just to conclude, I think the decision on the best maintenance therapy cannot be generalized. Of course, you have to individualize according to several factors. There are patient characteristics, there are tumor characteristics, therapy and team characteristics. And so for each patient, you may decide what is the best treatment. And my take-home message is that maintenance therapy with PARP inhibitors in frontline have changed the natural history of patients with high-grade serous ovarian cancer, and particularly those with genomic instability. BRCA and HRD testing is mandatory for patient selection. Therapeutic management of ovarian cancer in multiple line setting has shifted dramatically with the first line overall survival data from SOLO-1 and PAOLA-1 raising the hope of a potential cure. The role of bevacizumab is still under discussion. Probably we do need new biomarkers beyond BRCA and GIS to identify patients that will progress on or shortly after PARP inhibitor, but taken together, current evidence highlights the importance of introducing PARP inhibitor as early as possible for eligible patients. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Nicoletta. That was incredible. We're going to turn to our first video. The second opinion with Dr. Jonathan Letterman.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice. And to make this CME meeting more relevant and practical, I met separately with 3 noted clinical investigators. Professor Jonathan Letterman from the UCL Cancer Institute in London, United Kingdom. Dr. Ursula Matalonis from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. And Dr. Angela Secord from the Duke Cancer Institute in Durham, North Carolina, to brainstorm about clinical scenarios and related research data sets in advanced ovarian cancer to present to the faculty for their input. To begin, Professor Letterman told me about a 52-year-old woman who presented in 2020 with ascites and pleural effusion, a complex ovarian mass, and a metal thickening on CT. She was also found to have a germline BRCA1 mutation and was treated with neoadjuvant carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab.
She had a very good response to chemotherapy, perhaps because she had a BRCA1 mutation, and then, you know, completed bevacizumab and olaparib. She was given the bevacizumab because she had pleural fluid. She completed all her treatment, but unfortunately, she suffered a relapse. We picked up this relapse on CT scanning and not on a CA125 elevation. She had para-aortic lymph node involvement. So those patients now, more and more, are being offered surgery, as this lady was, at the time of her recurrence. She went ahead, had surgery, and then we gave her chemotherapy with carboplatin and liposomal doxorubicin.
If you could have accessed a PARP inhibitor in this patient with a recurrence 3 years after stopping olaparib-bev, would you have?
Yes, I would, and I would have probably given her rucaparib, having had olaparib in the front line, but you know, I could have equally given her niraparib. I mean, the answer is, of course, we don't actually know to what extent patients will benefit from retreatment with a PARP inhibitor, and those studies need to be done, and some of them are being planned at the moment.
Great. So I think we've got some very interesting things brought up with Dr. Letterman's video, and I want to have our esteemed faculty answer some of these questions. Let's start with you, Alex. How do you think through, we heard a little bit about what Nicoletta thinks, so how do you think through upfront maintenance therapy in patients that have either a somatic or germline BRCA mutation? Do you consider things like ascites, pleural effusions in your care, and which PARP inhibitor do you prefer? We won't tell. We'll keep it to ourselves. And then how do you decide on Bev? And then how long do you continue maintenance? So just summarize that as quick as you can.
Thanks, Shannon. So I do selective use of bevacizumab in the first-line treatment of ovary cancer. So yes, this patient, I would have given her bevacizumab with chemotherapy. And because she had she has BRCA1 mutation, at the end of our treatment with chemo, I would have done switch maintenance with the PIOLA-1 regimen and combine Bev with olaparib. I mean, stop the Bev after 12 treatments and then continue olaparib for 24 months.
Okay. Sounds pretty straightforward. Godfrey, what about you? How do you think about that? And also, what would you do if it was an BRCA wild type but HRD positive patient?
So if it's a BRC wild type HRD deficient, right?
Yeah,
patient,
test positive.
I would definitely consider the PAOLA data, which shows a survival benefit. But I do in clinic separate the indication for a PARP inhibitor from the indication for bevacizumab. I do use the subset analysis where patients, as Dr. Letterman pointed out, had ascites, had residual disease after cytoreductive surgery, where angiogenesis seems to play an important role. I don't know yet if there's a true synergy between bevacizumab and a PARP inhibitor, and these ongoing studies that Nicola pointed out will show us that, or if it's an additive effect. Of the two, clearly the PARP inhibitor has the greatest impact, in my opinion, in the BRCA mutation and in the HRD deficient. So there's a second choice. Do you add Bev or not?
Okay. And is there anybody that you really try to avoid Bev in?
If there's clearly a contraindication, renal toxicity, hypertension, someone who's optimally cytoreduced with a stage 3A, and you look at the HRD deficiency data, that excellent outcome in this low-risk group, I don't think Bev will add that much to the outcome. Clearly, that's a patient that needs a PARP inhibitor.
Okay. And Nicoletta, can you talk to us a little bit about... Here we go. situations that you might offer a PARP inhibitor with wild-type HRD-negative disease?
Yeah, I must say very, very rarely because, of course, I'm afraid of a possible, negative impact on subsequent lines. So I use the response criterion that I show you. So if I have a patient with bulky disease and she presents with a very, very good response to platinum, let's say undergoing interval, the back surgery with a CRS of 3, which means almost complete pathological response. In this case, even though the tumor is negative at the test, which does not mean that it's really negative, maybe positive, in fact. So in this case, I may consider to use the PARP inhibitor.
Those are great points. You gave us a masterclass on testing. Do you have a particular genetic testing platform that you love the best, or do you find that there's a difference in efficacy and detection of these somatic and germline mutations? And same thing with HRD. Do you have a particular platform you really like the best?
Yeah, we now use an in-house test. We have done a lot of correlation with the Myriad My Choice, so our pathologists are using now based on SOPHiA genetics. We correlate. We saw that there was a very, very good correlation with the Myriad, so we go with that. Somatic germline, that's a good question. The impression is that probably the germline tend to do a little bit better than the somatic, but of course, I treat them in the same way. So if there is a mutation, for sure, PARP inhibitor should be used.
Gottfried?
Yeah, I particularly like that Nicoletta includes clinical factors because HRD deficiency is a continuous variable. It's not dichotomous. And
that's
if
right.
You are close to the cutoff, it's very arbitrary. And I just don't think we know if there's not someone who's close to the cutoff may not benefit, and a CRS score of 3. The association between platinum response and PARP does sway me to say I would discuss it with the patient.
Well, and these inconclusive results that are being asked about as well, I mean, often that's because we had such a great response to chemotherapy, right? We often see this when we've given neoadjuvant. Maybe we didn't have enough tissue from that biopsy to get an effective HRD test, and then we go to use our debulking surgery tissue and there's no tumor left, right?
Exactly.
So that inconclusive test actually could be a conclusive example that you had a really great response to therapy. So, Alex, how often do you encounter patients with recurrent disease on imaging but no elevation of CA125? And with that, do you see any role for ctDNA in this space?
These patients are not common. They are very rare. But yes, I do encounter them. The typical patient would have had a normal CA125 at the time of diagnosis, even though she had widespread disease in the peritoneal cavity. And so, as a matter of policy, I don't actually follow them with CA125. I do intermittent CT scan. And yes, this, in my opinion, is a patient that will be a clear example of the perfect patient for ctDNA or MRD monitoring.
Yeah.
Although there is no data to advise me on what I would do with the result of that monitoring.
Yeah, I think that's the tricky part. We all have, I think, this expectation of the potential of using ctDNA in this exact space, but I don't know that we have the data quite yet, but hopefully very smart people are generating those. This next question is really interesting. I'll try to do my best to tackle it, and then you guys can jump in. But around rechallenge with a PARP inhibitor. So you have a patient who has got a PARP inhibitor in the upfront maintenance, subsequently experienced disease progression. So what kind of features and factors would you consider? So, you know, I think that first factor, time off treatment, is huge, right? So I think it's a very different situation if the patient experienced progression on a PARP inhibitor versus stopping a PARP inhibitor and having a subsequent progression. That, to me, is a very different clinical. I would feel a little bit more comfortable and a little bit more enthusiastic about potentially retreating with a PARP inhibitor if they had some time off of that treatment. But I think I would start with platinum and use what Nicoletta told us and see if there's response to chemotherapy as that predictor. So I think you had that opportunity to potentially use that. Have you guys done this? Do you guys use the same PARP? Do you use a different one? I don't know. Alex, do you want to pipe
in? Yes, I have.
Yeah.
In the example given by Professor Lederman, the patient actually had a PFS of about 3 years.
That's
after
right.
Stopping PARP inhibitor, I would clearly offer this patient a retreatment with PARP inhibitor, and I would have been happy to give her olaparib again.
Okay, perfect. Any differing opinions?
I think I would say yes. I've done it, and I'm doing it in BRCA mutation carriers that have a long platinum-free interval. The question is if they're HRD deficient. would you retreat? And, you know, the recommendations by the FDA has changed now that, strictly speaking, it would be off-label use. But
right. Good point.
I think the pendulum has swung back. First, we've used PARP inhibitors too broadly, and now we've restricted our access. And I recall many patients that have responded very well to a second-line maintenance therapy. And as Dr. Lederman pointed out, we don't have data yet in patients that have received PARP inhibitors in the frontline setting. The Oreo data, as you know, is not representative of
no.
what we are doing.
Very now. Heavily pretreated. Yeah,
I do agree, absolutely. I would consider a challenge in a BRCA patients only, not in HD. Maybe very good response, very long platinum-free interval, very long, very good response to platinum. I would consider, hopefully, maybe a new generation of PARP will come.
Oh, yes.
And that would be even better Great if
point.
We can test that, yeah.
Okay, that was awesome. I think those are questions we all are experiencing every day in the clinic. But now it's time to move on to something completely different. So I am going to tackle strategies targeting folate receptor alpha in advanced ovarian cancer over the next few minutes. And I think this is an area, obviously, there's been an explosion of development in this space, and so I'll try to do my best to cover it in just a short period of time. But before I get into the specific agents that we've been looking at, it's important just to make sure we level set around folate receptor alpha itself, right? So this is a cell surface receptor. It modulates folate transport into the cells. It is, importantly, limited expression on normal cells, and that's really important when we're targeting something to help avoid adverse events, and it's very highly upregulated in our favorite cancers, right? Ovarian cancer, endometrial. I guess we don't really have a favorite cancer, but maybe a cancer we prefer to study. You do have to be careful because it can be expressed on the alveoli of the lungs and on the renal proximal tubules, but it seems that because it's on the cells facing the alveolar and tubular lumen, you don't see as much toxicity in those organs. And of course, the expression is going to vary based on the histology type, with about 35 to 40% of all ovarian cancers having some type of high expression, but you can see it's much more commonly expressed in high-grade serous, although there is expression in low-grade, about 50%, and about 30% in clear cells. So really important to consider testing in all of your epithelial ovarian cancers. And we don't really know prognostically. There's definitely mixed reports, but it does seem to potentially be associated with worse outcomes. And then, of course, the testing, we've really done a great job of refining this. And Dr. Moore, who did a lot of the preliminary work with mirvetuximab, really helped us to define exactly what folate receptor alpha positivity is. And using that PS2 scoring really is very critical. There are a number of commercial and institutional options that are available. And, of course, use your favorite. But the point is to try to determine what is what patient in front of you might potentially benefit from a folate receptor testing. And I have some really beautiful slides here just for your education from my pathologist talking about the different types of staining. But the bottom line is we really need to see moderate to strong membranous staining and avoiding that cytoplasmic staining. So, of course, mirvetuximab was the first folate receptor alpha-targeted ADC approved for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, and we hope there will be more soon. This is an antibody-drug conjugate with that folate receptor antibody binding, a nice cleavable linker, and then the maytansinoid DM4 payload. And, of course, here's our press release of when we got the accelerated approval. And the accelerated approval was based on the SORAYA trial, which was in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. They allowed prior Bev, 1 to 3 priors. Everybody got mirvetuximab at that 6 mg per kg adjusted ideal body weight every 3 weeks. And the primary endpoint was objective response. And here it was, right? We were so excited. 32% investigator-assessed objective response, and the duration of response, a very impressive 7 months. And again, this led to our approval. And then our confirmatory trial was MIRASOL, which was the randomized phase 3, again, in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer versus investigator's choice chemotherapy, either paclitaxel, pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, or topotecan, and the primary endpoint being progression-free survival, again, investigator-assessed. And here's our superiority. We love an overall survival benefit. This was one of the first, although we're going to see many trials now by my esteemed faculty that have also demonstrated overall survival benefit with agents in ovarian cancer. But, you know, of course, this hazard ratio was so exciting with reduction in the risk of progression and reduction in improvement in overall survival. And then, of course, we also like to see response, right? That helps improve our patients' symptoms and outcomes. And we did see an improvement in objective response rate as well as tumor reduction versus investigator's choice chemotherapy. Now, we do have some growing data outside of platinum resistance for mirvetuximab. These are the data from the PICCOLO study, which was a single-agent mirvetuximab study in platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer. You can see there were 79 patients enrolled with a, you know, pretty low pretreatment, 62% with 1 to 2 prior lines of therapy. Most had had taxanes and had been exposed in multiple lines. There was a high proportion of patients with exposure to PARP, and you can see 74% with progression on PARP. So very relevant as we're talking about predictors of platinum sensitivity and what to do with our patients. This is a really nice study. And they demonstrated a very nice outcome, 51.9% response rate. You can see that beautiful. The majority of the patients had some kind of reduction in their tumor on that waterfall plot. So very exciting data. And for us, it is compendium listed. So this is something you can consider. And then I think it's really important also to look at the duration of benefit. So you have a duration of response of 8 months, progression-free survival of about 7 months, and in a pretreated platinum-sensitive population, this is good. And they did a really nice job of also looking at some of the relevant subgroups that we would be interested in. You can see a little bit of a reduction in the benefit in those patients that had prior PARP, but interestingly, if they did not have progressive disease, then a little bit higher. So you can start to tease out clinical scenarios in which MIRV might be an option. And of course, our additional confirmatory study, which will be the GLORIOSA study, looking at mirvetuximab plus bevacizumab in the maintenance setting. So this is, I believe, done enrolling, so hopefully we'll be getting data from these this one soon. But mirvetuximab's not the only kid on the block, right? So we've got a number of other agents that are in development for folate receptor, and you can see them listed here in no particular order. We've got SOFI-M. I love how all of them, they're trying to make it easy for us. So yes, sofatibart-mipitecan is SOFI-M. And this is an exatecan payload. We have not heard about the DAR as yet. The linker is also proprietary, so we don't have a lot of information there. But in the preliminary data, some of which was presented today, you see a 50% response rate in the all-comers, a little bit of separation based on high expression, 75% or above at 54%, versus low expression at 40%, but pretty consistent across levels of expression, you know, that get as low as 25%, so pretty intriguing. Rina-S, or Rinatabart's exatecan, also an exatecan payload. We're seeing a theme here. This has got a DAR of 8 with a protease cleavable linker. A 38% overall response, where you start to tease out a little bit here, a 68% response in those high expressors, and a 30% response in low expressors. And of course, for both SOFI-M, Rina-S, we don't yet have progression-free survival, overall survival data, but I'm sure we will get those from upcoming trials. Teruvatatug, that one's really tough for me. TSAM, this is a samrotecan payload, another topotecan, topo 1 isomerase inhibitor. This one has a 53% overall response rate, again, 61 and high, 48 low. Very, very promising responses regardless of the expression, so super exciting. So bottom line, the data are promising and very consistent across these drugs. And so the upcoming trials that are going to look at these in phase 3 are really going to be quite informative. And this is just a little bit of a deeper dive on some of the data that I just mentioned, that 53% response rate for TSAM, the 50% response rate for SOFI-M. And I think this is a nice graph because it kind of shows that response across the different expression levels. And you can see really deep responses, deep objective responses, despite
the expression levels going quite low. And then Rina S, both in, this was an ovary end as well as endometrial cancer with a nice 50% response rate as well. And here they come, right? So we're going to have a lot of crowded rooms here, but hopefully all of you are opening one or more of the trials that are going to really define which or all of these we might be using in this space. So we've got the TSAM study, the Framework 01, which is the Sophie M study, and the Rainfall study. Now, I will call your attention to, let me see if I can go backwards again. Come on, baby. That the TSAM study is a pure, is going to be a platinum resistant study, so looking at treatment. The framework is in platinum resistant, is looking at the Sophie M versus investigator's choice, and then it also has a platinum sensitive space where they're looking at it as a treatment, so to lose platinum versus investigator's choice, and then the Rainfall study is a pure maintenance study. So I think there's a lot going on. We're very excited about those things, and I'm excited to talk to our esteemed panel about folate receptor. So let's go to a video.
The next case, presented by Dr. Matalonis, is a 55-year-old woman with a BRCA1 mutated ovarian cancer with disease progression after platinum doublets and PARP inhibition, but with an elevated folate receptor alpha level.
She started mirvetuximab at 6 milligrams per kilo IV, and after two cycles had a very nice decrease in her cancer burden, with decrease in the size of multiple peritoneal implants, but did have grade 2 eye toxicity. She presented with blurred vision. Her ophthalmologist noted confluent microcysts, and also she had a 3-line drop in her eyesight acuity. Mirvetuximab was held until there was improvement in eyesight and improvement in the microcysts. And then I did drop her down one dose from 6 down to 5 milligrams per kilo. And this is from the FDA package insert. She had confluent superficial keratitis. And I would be curious for the esteemed panel, for this lady, would you have dropped the dose of mirvetuximab from 6 to 5, or would you have continued at 6 milligrams per kilogram? So now, after four cycles, the radiologist, the report did show new multifocal ground glass opacities in bilateral lungs and scattered 1 to 2 millimeter pulmonary nodules, which could be infectious or inflammatory. And she did have symptoms. So she was grade 2, had grade 2 pneumonitis, and I withheld until grade 1 or less. I involved pulmonary, and we ended up not starting steroids, but just gave the pneumonitis some time and waited for improvement.
So any questions for the faculty?
Yeah. We don't typically associate pneumonitis with mirvetuximab. We associate eye toxicities with MIRV. But clearly, pneumonitis can happen around 10% of the time, mostly low grade. But how do you follow for pneumonitis? Do you follow every two cycles, or do you do less frequent chest CT scans, especially in the setting of a patient who does not have known lung metastases?
Okay, so let's kick it off. Gottfried, I would love to hear about how you're currently sequencing MIRV for your patients with folate receptor alpha positive platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. Are you always doing monotherapy? Are you using it with the compendium listing with bevacizumab? What do you do?
Yeah, so I do use compendia listing, NCCN guidelines, so because I think it's a very variable immunohistochemistry test. If they are 75% positive, I do proceed with single-agent therapy. Unfortunately, the NCCN guidelines do recommend if it's 25 or more, it is then indicated to give it with bevacizumab. That may be sufficient for the authorization process, but then I think the treating physician should decide whether to give or not the bev, depending on the comorbidities. But I try to provide access at lower levels of folate receptor.
Okay, that's interesting. Alex, what's your threshold for folate receptor alpha positivity and mirvetuximab? And, you know, I would be interested to hear, like, Gottfried, what would you try to do? Would you ever try to use it in a low expression patient, and why?
Oh, so thanks, Shannon. So, first of all, for those patients, we now have some very nice clinical trials that are open. So if I...
Perfect.
such a trial is open, I would like to put the patient on the trial. But in the absence of a trial, I still would want to take advantage of that molecular factor in treating her. So I'm very similar to Goffrey here. If it's less than 75% expression, I would still give mirvetuximab, but with bevacizumab.
Okay. And then what about for platinum? I was just going to go to you, Gottfried. What about for platinum sensitive? And please add whatever you want to add there too.
Yeah, I think, again, the folate receptor is a continuous variable, and I would not treat a patient where the result is zero, but is it 45, 50? You have different reviewers of the PATH slides. You send it to different labs. There's intrapatient heterogeneity. It's not a very robust biomarker. So I think weighing in from a clinical standpoint and making that judgment, I think it's great that the NCCN broadened that indication, because there's great data to show outstanding activity in anyone who is classified as more as 25%.
Yeah. And then what about platinum sensitive? I mean, we saw the Piccolo data, but I don't know if all our guests saw your very recent presentation just right before this session.
Well, I think my experience has been, as the other panel members in the audience will agree, this is an active drug in platinum-resistant recurrent disease. It's well-tolerated generally. And so, but we're only kicking the can a little bit further down the line. We're not curing anybody. So an active drug like that, we feel obliged to move into earlier lines of treatment. And the question is, can we combine it with a carboplatin? And we just had the privilege to show the data on a phase 2 study where it's very well combinable with platinums with minimal toxicity. But the interesting thing is, if you compare it to Piccolo, was it really that much better? And we're not supposed to compare between studies, but it was in the same ballpark range, which raises the question, do we really need a platinum, particularly in patients that progress on a PARP inhibitor? And maybe that's another reason to accrue to the studies that are looking at a single-agent ADC in platinum-sensitive disease, particularly those that have progressed on a PARP inhibitor. And that allows you to keep a platinum for later. So a really interesting question.
Yeah, it was amazing work. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. Let's turn a little bit to toxicity. Nicoletta, how do you generally screen for ocular toxicities in patients with receiving mirvetuximab?
Yeah, I would suggest for sure you have to have a very good friend ophthalmologist. That's the best thing to do. Because recently I spoke with one of them and they said, well, they are not scared at all. I mean, what it is scaring to us, for them, is not scaring at all. I mean, the microcystal, what it is, I mean, no problem. So I think it's very important to develop a partnership with an ophthalmologist to understand really toxicity. So you have to do a baseline exam, of course, and then follow the patient for the symptoms. And typically you may go back to the ophthalmology in case of symptoms. Typically that's what I do, or maybe every 3 cycles. But again, I think we have to learn a lot about the management of this toxicity, because we are for us it's kind of new, but for the ophthalmologist, this kind of damage is quite common. And
right.
So, and they're not afraid at all. So yes, we need to understand much more.
Yeah. Godfrey, go ahead.
Yeah, I thought it interesting on the previous case that Ursula presented was a question, do you delay or do you dose reduce when you go forward? And I think the cornea is a magnificent avascular organ, which is known to completely recycle within 3 weeks. So that I personally believe giving it time allows you to heal more than a dose reduction. So my first step would be to delay rather than dose reduce, but I don't think we have good data to say what really changes it. But I prefer to do that first. I'd be interested to hear.
Yeah, Alex, go ahead.
So I agree with my two colleagues in what they said. I also agree with Goffrey that I would probably delay and restart on the same dose. But I just want to talk to the audience about the question of the ophthalmologist, because depending on where you practice, especially in the United States,
great point,
access to ophthalmologists can be challenging. And so it's actually okay to start having these patients follow with an optometrist, not necessarily an ophthalmologist. I have found it much easier to get them to optometrists, and then if the problem appears to be much more serious, then, of course, an ophthalmologist. Because preventive measures are available that you can work with the optometrists to help these patients with.
It's a great point. We often say eye care professional, right? So somebody who knows the eye a little better than we do. And yeah, we often in Houston, we're using our optometrists a ton for that very reason. Gottfried, how do you monitor for pneumonitis? I was a little surprised this case is not the classic case. And how do you manage grade one versus grade two? And would you re-challenge?
Yeah, my practice has changed because being involved in the early clinical trials, I must say our approach was a little more nonchalant in the sense that we didn't jump right straight into holding the drug or getting a pulmonologist involved. And Ursula's case really shows getting a pulmonologist involved in grade one, making a balanced decision whether steroids are necessary. This case, the patient was symptomatic, so I'm surprised they didn't treat her with steroids. I think with the recent data, it really requires aggressive mitigation to prevent grade five toxicities. And if we do that, hold, get a pulmonologist involved. If you have ground glass opacities, do a scan every 2 months. I think we can keep it manageable. But we have to be a little more aggressive in looking out for it and getting pulmonologists and starting steroids. Even in an asymptomatic patient, I tend to say if there's clear change over a brief period, I would put her on a quick steroid taper. And it's not the steroid taper that you need for an immune checkpoint inhibitor that goes over 2 months. You can get away with much shorter and quicker tapering.
Yeah. And then just to close us out, I'll tackle this very hefty question, which is basically just asking us what we think of the novel agents that are coming. And I'll speak for the panel, and they can do thumbs up, thumbs down, and say, I mean, certainly the response rates look intriguing. We love the idea of lower expression. I think they're being very appropriately looked at across platinum sensitivity, platinum resistance. And so I think there's a ton of enthusiasm about these novel agents and hope that they will be even more successful than mirvetuximab. So now we'll go on to something completely different. Dr. Oluwaiye, please take us through other investigational strategies.
Thank you. For those who are the plenary session on Friday, I have now learned how to use the microphone much better. So the story of ovarian cancer is depicted in this very basic diagram here. And if you look at the patients at the top are those patients for whom platinum is still an option. And generally speaking, in those patients, you are going to continue using some type of platinum-containing regimen. But I think Godfrey mentioned in one of his responses that we're not currently thinking that we can cure any of these patients, whether they are platinum-sensitive recurrent disease or platinum-resistant recurrent disease. But certainly, the platinum-resistant cohort are much more difficult to treat. And so, you know, second-line platinum therapy in patients with ovary cancer previously treated with platinum is actually an old concept. And it's not a categorical sort of situation, it's a continuum. And this study that is very old by Professor Markman showed that the distance from the last platinum exposure, the wider that distance, the more likely you're going to get a response again. You still get a response to platinum, even in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer patients, but it's so small that it's not worth trying. And so this study here is KEYNOTE-B96, led by my able colleague, Professor Colombo, who we are honored to have here today, is a study done in platinum-resistant ovary cancer who patients who have had two lines of therapy or less, and a large trial that recruited 643 patients and randomized them 1-to-1 to receive pembrolizumab, weekly paclitaxel. The BEV was at the discretion of the treating physician, but I can tell you that most of the patients, and Nicoletta can correct me, I think close to 80% of them did receive BEV. And of course, trial is a positive trial with progression-free survival shown here for both the ITT population and CPS more than one population. The hazard ratios are actually quite close, 0.75, 0.73. And we also have overall survival in the CPS more than one population in this interim analysis too, and with a very nice hazard ratio of 0.76, indicating 24% reduction in the risk of death, which was really good to see. And, you know, the regimen was very well tolerated. I mean, there was nothing new in the toxicity profile that we did not know before. This is, by the way, a novel combination of agents. It's not a novel. Each individual agent in the trial was not new. Of course, as expected, the immune-related adverse events were more on the arm that received pembrolizumab because of that arm containing an immune agent. And FDA has approved this regimen for platinum-resistant ovary cancer with CPS more than one in the tissue, and so it's now an available regimen. This is the Rosella study, which is a combination of relacorilant with nab-paclitaxel weekly versus nab-paclitaxel weekly therapy in patients with platinum-resistant ovary cancer. That trial allowed up to three lines of therapy, and the mechanism of the of action of the agent is as shown here. Basically, glucocorticoid receptor signaling helps the pro-carcinogenic or anti-apoptotic genes, like two of them are listed there, SGK1 and DUSP1, and the proteins from those pathways, BAC and BACs listed here, all help the cancer to continue dividing in perpetuity. When you give relacorilant, which is a selective competitive receptor antagonist to the glucocorticoid receptor, you block that pathway, or you inhibit that pathway, and taxane is then allowed to come in and make the cancer go apoptotic, die. In Rosella, we gave the relacorilant, I should say the relacorilant agent was given the day before, the day of, the day after nab-paclitaxel infusion, compared to weekly nab-paclitaxel infusion in that trial. The dual primary endpoints were progression-free survival by BICR and overall survival. Nab-paclitaxel was chosen as a choice because it was necessary to avoid the use of high-dose steroid in these patients. And the progression-free survival here showed a positive result with a hazard ratio that you can see here that is 0.7, 30% reduction in the risk of progression or death. And the overall survival is shown here again positive with a statistically significant 35% reduction in the risk of death. And the morphology of the curve looks like the benefit was sustained for a long period of time. And subsequent therapies received by the patient were seen in these diagrams that show very strikingly similar treatment across the two arms of the trial. Toxicity was very, moderate in the trial, and honestly speaking, driven by the nab-paclitaxel infusion. And the regimen containing relacorilant combination with nab-paclitaxel is now FDA approved for the treatment of platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. And so we're going to be talking about the question of sequencing, which I can tell the audience is a good problem to have. Rosella regimen is being advanced further into other areas of cancer treatment. We are in Bella, which is a subsequent trial that is being done following Rosella reading out. It's a combination of relacorilant with nab-paclitaxel, now with bevacizumab. And this trial has actually finished enrolling, at least for the platinum-resistant cohort. It was also subsequently modified and done in platinum-sensitive recurrent ovary cancer as well. And we're going to know that result soon. And actually, it was done in platinum in endometrial cancer too, in a modification to the Bella study. So, in conclusions, progress in the last decade surpasses what we achieved in the previous preceding four decades. And better understanding of biology has been used to develop new agents for therapy, and expanded systemic options are now available to our patients, and we have to deal with the question of sequencing. And the key advances that have been made have led to all the a host of targeted therapies that are currently in development, and we're excitedly waiting to see the outcome of those studies. The immediate future, we're very happy to say, looks very promising for our patients. Thank you.
Great job. That was amazing. You know, you don't often have all of the principal investigators reviewing data for you from their trials in a personal way. So let's go to our video.
The next case, presented by Dr. Secord, was a 69-year-old woman with a germline BRCA2 mutation who was status post multiple surgeries, intraperitoneal chemotherapy, but with further progression of platinum-resistant disease.
We obtained tumor testing for her. It was FR-alpha. She had 100% expression, which I really haven't seen that often, if ever. She was treated with mirvetuximab for 9 cycles and did really well in this treatment, but subsequently had disease progression. So I wanted to ask this panel, what would they recommend for a patient with platinum-resistant ovarian cancer who's been heavily pretreated? Would you recommend a B96 regimen with weekly paclitaxel, pembrolizumab with or without Bev, or the Rosella regimen with weekly nab-paclitaxel and relacorilant, or cyclophosphamide, pembrolizumab, and bevacizumab, topotecan, or gemcitabine? Are you utilizing the B96 regimen, and what has been your experience? And then also wondering about your experience with the Rosella regimen. What kind of side effects are you seeing with this combination, and how would you reduce the side effects? What I've seen most commonly is fatigue with relacorilant, and also monitoring closely for neutropenia and adding growth factor support. What has been your experience in terms of the efficacy of the Rosella regimen? And what are your thoughts in terms of if you have to make a decision between pembrolizumab, paclitaxel with or without Bev versus weekly nab-paclitaxel and relacorilant?
So what happened with this patient?
I got compassionate release for her for weekly nab-paclitaxel with relacorilant, and she's been on treatment now for 5 cycles.
So a lot to unpack, there. We'll start with you, Nicoletta. Now that you have both available, how are you considering sequencing? Well, when you do, in Europe, how are you sequencing relacorilant nab-paclitaxel with pembrolizumab and chemo relative to each other, relative to other antibody drug conjugates?
Yeah, so I think the population included in the trial were slightly different. As you know, one of the requirements in the Rosella was the prior bevacizumab in all patients and up to 3 prior lines. In our study, B96, you know, bevacizumab could be used or not, but we also were able to re-challenge the patients with bevacizumab, and we limited to 2 prior lines because, you know, it makes sense when you use immunotherapy not to have too many prior regimens. So I think we should adapt for it. I don't think one size fits all, so you have to understand for each patient what is the best solution. What I can tell you that I don't see a limitation in using both of them, because actually we have experienced that you may re-challenge patients with weekly taxane with success. And as a matter of fact, in the B96, we had patients with prior weekly paclitaxel, quite a lot of them, and they were re-challenged with weekly paclitaxel again with efficacy. So probably we have to find a place for, why not, both of them, depending on the patient characteristics, tumor characteristics. But I'm confident that we may be able to use maybe both regimens. Yeah.
Any difference of opinion? Gottfried, would you want to pipe in?
Well, like Angela's comment that she provided a third option, which was a non-taxane option, which was oral cyclophosphamide with pembrolizumab and bevacizumab. In my practice, that would be a better trade-off for a patient. I think no alopecia. The other question I had, it's rare to have both PIs here.
Incredible.
Of both either Abraxane and paclitaxel. How long did you give the chemotherapy? Did patients go on just with immunotherapy and Avastin? Did you stop, or did they really have to continue with all three drugs? Because there is always the issue of cumulative toxicity.
Yeah, there was no fixed duration, B96. They could continue until they were having benefit and toxicity. The median weeks, however, in the pembro arm was 22 weeks of paclitaxel. And the remaining stop treatment and continue only with pembro and bevacizumab. So, but according to the protocol, they could have continued. Oh. You know, that there was no fixed number of cycles to be given.
There seems to be this continued diversion of curves when they continue basically on a maintenance therapy, even if they stop chemotherapy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's very important. Because you have to look at the tails. For me, the tails of the curves are very important. And you see, you know, and remember, we have a very long follow-up because it's more than 37 months follow-up now. So the results are pretty stable. We don't have a lot of sensory in at the end. And and you see the tail of the curves diverge. So we have quite a lot of patients still progression-free after, you know, like 42 months compared to the placebo.
For me, that's reassuring that you don't have to plow through with paclitaxel to get the survival benefit.
No, the median was 22 weeks. We're 22 weeks, so I think it's reasonable,
Perfect. And I guess, Alex, I would love to hear, and I know Dr. Secord wanted to hear what your experience has been with the efficacy of the combination of relacorilant and nab-paclitaxel. And we didn't hear anything about glucocorticoid receptor expression. Does that matter? Is that something we should be checking?
So the first question, Shannon, so the efficacy of the relacorilant regimen is what we saw at this meeting 2 days ago. It's a very effective regimen. Without any question from the overall survival data with a hazard ratio that is so impressive. But just as important as the efficacy, what I'm much more impressed with the combination is the very, very manageable side effect profile. Relacorilant almost contributed nothing to adverse events. If you look at the patients that dropped off the trial because or discontinued treatment because of adverse events, the line was superimposed on top of each other, which means there was no contribution from relacorilant. And the design of the trial was such that if we were going to interrupt therapy, both agents had to be interrupted because we think relacorilant works by helping the chemotherapy in a synergistic fashion. And your second question is that, the answer to your second question, sorry, is that no, it does not matter what the level of glucocorticoid receptor expression is. Number one, glucocorticoid receptor is expressed in over 95% of ovary cancer tissue. And that's if you use standard assay. If you use mRNA-dependent assay, it's 100%. So when we looked at correlation of efficacy with glucocorticoid receptor expression level, they did not correlate, which is reassuring. That is why it's approved in all comers.
Yeah, I had a poster of ESGO showing this very recently, so there was no correlation with the receptor.
Wonderful. Thank you. Godfrey?
One question for Alex. Do you expect any hesitancy to using nab-paclitaxel? Because interesting to ask the audience, it's not a common drug that we use, and we're using two new drugs. Is there hesitancy? And sometimes we like steroids because they treat nausea. And do you see manageable nausea in your trial?
Yes, we saw manageable nausea in the trial, but the question of nab-paclitaxel is actually been answered very, very, you know, nicely by two very well done phase two trials looking at the efficacy of nab-paclitaxel in ovarian cancer. One of them by Professor Rob Coleman, and it showed a very, nice efficacy that was very similar to what we see with paclitaxel. So there's no problem there. The question of paclitaxel is the one that I addressed briefly when I was presenting, which is whether you want to really give high-dose steroid to a patient that you're going to be given a selective antagonist to glucocorticoid receptor to. It's kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But what I can say to you is, if you are able to get the paclitaxel to the patient without steroid, there is nothing stopping you from using it with a relacorilant. That is not the approved FDA indication, though. I need to say that quickly.
Well, staying on that same tip of round management, it would be great to kind of hear, Nicoletta, how you are monitoring maybe the CBCs and looking at neutropenia on this regimen.
Yeah, of course, myelotoxicity is one of the important side effects that you have to monitor. Actually, when I was the PI of the phase 2, which led to the ROSELLA trial design, and at that time, we were using in all patients prophylactic G-CSF.
Mm-hmm.
But then we realized that probably was not necessary, so now in the ROSELLA was left to the investigator. So it's very important to monitor, and when it's needed, you can use it, but it's not necessary in all patients. You know, it's according to the tolerability that you may assess. But of course, you have to pay attention to that, yes.
Yeah. And then, Alex, do you need to monitor for adrenal insufficiency in these patients? And have you given supplemental glucocorticoids in patients undergoing surgical procedures? So we'd love to get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty details on this so we can be prepared as we're prescribing it for our patients.
Very good question, especially if you say you're antagonizing glucocorticoid receptors. And so, no, in the ROSELLA trial, we did not see any evidence of adrenal insufficiency. And there was no patient that, in my practice, actually, and I put some of the most patients on the trial in the United States, I didn't have to put any of my patients on G-CSF support. But if it's needed, it's as, you know, by institutional sort of practice.
Yeah, Nico?
Yeah, I want to comment on the adrenal insufficiency, because what we are talking about is just functional adrenal insufficiency, because it's not the cortisol level, because we block the receptor. So the cortisol may be normal, but it is the receptor. So I think it's more about the symptoms of the patients, which is mainly the fatigue. So if you have a severe fatigue, if you have severe hypotension, hypoglycemia, then you may consider to give some supplement, you know, because again,
great
you have
point.
To look more, not, well, of course, you may have ACTH high, but, you know, the most important thing is the symptom that the patient, and we know that fatigue is one
right.
of the main, you know, side effects of this drug.
I don't disagree. It's just that, unfortunately, nab-paclitaxel also causes fatigue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So, one of the main overlapping toxicities, which is always tricky. Okay, so now that we've covered all that, Alex, what about, so we heard about this a little bit. You think you could potentially do a combination with relacorilant beyond nab-paclitaxel, maybe with paclitaxel. Would you consider it with any other agent?
You know, that is a very interesting question, Shannon. Actually, the first question that I was asked at the ASCO presentation was that if this drug, what it does is to enhance chemosensitivity, why are you combining it with nab-paclitaxel? Why not with another agent?
Yeah.
I agree with that question. I think we should try to combine relacorilant with other agents. The sponsor for this regimen is a young, prosperous company. I cannot see how they're not going to go that route. Maybe relacorilant with ADC, relacorilant with other chemos, with anti-angiogenic agents. That's been done in Bella already. So, yeah.
Okay, interesting. And then let's transition to the B96. So, Nicoletta, do you think that regimen, that we are truly increasing the likelihood of long-term survival, or dare we say cure? And then how did you decide, or how are you going to decide when to use bevacizumab with this regimen, given it was optional?
Yes. So the data we have so far, as I said, with quite a long follow-up, the median follow-up for the final analysis is 37 months, showed an improvement in survival in the intention-to-treat population, and particularly in the PD-L1 positive, but also in the intention-to-treat. So, yes, I do believe that for some of these patients, you know, you see, as we commented before, the tail of the curves is quite interesting to look, because you see a huge difference, more than 20% progression-free at 42 months compared to 8%. So it's quite impressive. Bevacizumab. I love bevacizumab. That's my disclosure. So I use bevacizumab almost always. I mean, whenever I can. I think it's a good drug. And you can use it more than once. And so in this case, yes, if there are no contraindication, if the patient may tolerate, I would consider to add bevacizumab together with pembro, even though, if you look at the forest plot, the benefit of adding pembrolizumab was seen with or without bevacizumab. So it is not completely necessary, but I do believe bevacizumab can add also to the mechanism of action and the influence in the microenvironment. So I think is an important drug to combine with IO.
And it seems in the study, the majority of those patients did get bevacizumab, and so there's something to that combination. We also have seen data that, you know, metronomic chemotherapy with bevacizumab, it creates a more hypoxic situation. You see that synergy. So it makes sense scientifically, I think, to consider all of them. Now, this question gets into the overall survival advantage with B96 and considering it in a patient with PD-L1 negative disease. And, you know, I think we obviously are label driven and we practice according to the label, but I think that, you know, you just said that ITT population demonstrated overall survival benefits. So certainly it might be something to consider in a PD-L1, you know, negative patient, but, you know, looking at all other options, considering Alex's option and making that balance. Gottfried, what about pre-existing autoimmune conditions? Are there any specific conditions that cause you to withhold the use of checkpoint inhibition? And especially, I think, something that comes up a lot, not a lot, but questions that we get asked from other providers is around solid organ transplant. Like, what do you do there?
Yes, I think that's an important question because of the broad use, and we're now seeing more and more patients that have so-called contraindications. My first take is I would not automatically give up on it. For example, patients with rheumatoid arthritis, we've been able to successfully treat with the help of rheumatologists. I mean, there are very good immune suppressive agents that are known not to reverse the efficacy of an immune checkpoint inhibitor. So working with your rheumatology team will allow you. It really depends on what are the other alternative treatment options. And in some cases, you know, it is the best next treatment. And I would really try it. I even have treated patients with multiple sclerosis where the neurologist has said this is absolutely contraindicated, but it's weighing the risks towards the benefits of a microsatellite instable endometrial cancer patient that is on multiple sclerosis and now still living, clearly having deterioration. So I think it's an individualized decision. But there are great solutions to overcome potential side effects.
Perfect. And the last question as we're queuing up the next video is yes, right? So MSI-high ovarian cancer can happen. It's rare. We should be testing for MSI in all of our solid tumors and considering immunotherapy if we have the opportunity. So let's go to the next video.
The final case presented by Professor Letterman is a 70-year-old woman with a previous history in 2016 of surgery for stage 3 endometrioid high-grade carcinoma of the ovary. This was followed by postoperative carboplatin and paclitaxel, and in 2019, 3 years later, she presented with headaches and memory loss and was found on MRI of the brain to have a large, isolated, solitary metastasis in the left frontal lobe, which was removed surgically. 3 years later, she was found to have systemic disease without CNS progression, and since that time, has been treated with multiple rounds of chemotherapy and clinical trial participation. Brain imaging continues to be normal.
This is so interesting because, you know, usually when patients with ovarian cancer have a brain metastasis, it is usually associated with a very poor prognosis. But this patient had a solitary metastasis in 2019 in the brain, and that was treated. And she's still alive. I actually bumped into her into the street this week, actually. And she's had no recurrence of a brain metastasis. But some years after the brain metastasis was treated, she developed systemic recurrence. And she went on to chemotherapy. And then she had maintenance with PARP inhibitor. And, you know, eventually has become resistant to treatment. So it's interesting that the biology is sometimes different to what one expects. And these solitary brain metastases are very well worth treating.
This woman has not had an IO or PD-1 testing. Any thoughts about the B96 approach of pembrolizumab and weekly paclitaxel with or without Bev?
The big question I think that we all asked ourselves was, why was this trial positive when all of the other immune checkpoint inhibitor studies in ovarian cancer had been pretty negative, whether you looked at frontline or recurrent disease? So what's different about B96? Well, perhaps it's the weekly paclitaxel. We now have really quite a choice of treatment in the non-platinum group of patients. I mean, historically, we have had very little to offer these patients. We have the opportunity of using mirvetuximab in those patients who are folate alpha receptor positive. And the other drug that's coming down the line and not yet approved in Europe, but approved in the US, is relacorilant with nab-paclitaxel. So, you know, we're now in a situation where we actually have choices in patients in the non-platinum space that we just didn't have 2 or 3 years ago. And of course, we don't know at the moment how to make those choices.
Yeah, I think these are really good questions. Nicoletta, I would love to hear your theories. I gave mine. Yes. What do you think? How'd you do it? How'd you get it to be positive?
So first of all, I don't think, yes, it's the only phase 3 positive trial. But we have other evidences that immunotherapy could work. And we designed specifically the backbone of weekly paclitaxel because of preclinical data and clinical data showing that the metronomic chemotherapy together with pembrolizumab and possibly bevacizumab can have higher efficacy. There was the metronomic cyclophosphamide by Emese Siros data. There were another trial, phase 2 from Duke, showing the combination of weekly paclitaxel and pembro and bevacizumab to be very effective. So we had all of that. And even if you look at the AGO study, the randomized phase 3, where they randomized patients to receive atezo with chemo, unfortunately, they decided to use both PLD and weekly paclitaxel, so the trial was negative. But if you look at the subgroup with weekly paclitaxel, you see a possible benefit. So I think there are more than one evidence. And why is that? Because we know that paclitaxel may increase the expression of PD-L1 weekly, particularly weekly, is very important because it can cause immunogenic cell deaths and so increase both the T-cell infiltration, the neoantigen presentation, and modulate the microenvironment by decreasing the microsuppressive factors such as Treg. So I think there is a strong rationale, and I do believe that it is the weekly paclitaxel important. Maybe, as he said, also the metronomic cyclophosphamide could work. I have to say that my patients do not lose their hair with weekly paclitaxel because I use the cooling caps.
So you do every week.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Gottfried, what about patients with brain metastases? Is that common in your practice, or how often do you see it, and what do you do with those cases?
I think generally the pattern with better systemic treatments, patients experience brain mets more often, such as PARP inhibitors. Right. It just becomes more common. This was interesting because I think this case was an endometrioid ovarian cancer, so it opens up a complete different biology. I would be very interested to see who would consider treating it more like an endometrial cancer than an ovarian cancer, which opens up other treatment options. But unfortunately, brain mets have become more common, but it's also attribute to better systemic treatments now.
Yeah. And I mean, I think isolated
surgery is an option.
Absolutely.
You can consult with your radiation oncologist. And there are some agents that do cross that blood-brain barrier. Bevacizumab is one. So certainly things to consider. But lastly, we're going to move on to the most important thing here is making sure we know how to manage adverse events. Gottfried,
okay.
Take us home.
Great. Oopala. So I don't want to belabor this point because many of these topics have already been touched upon from the previous speakers, but I really wanted to conclude to see.
Clicker.
Oh, my clicker, sorry. We heard from Nicoletta that the landscape of PARP inhibitor use has completely changed, and this is 5 years ago, broad use as maintenance therapy and as actual treatment. This is what it looks like now. All of these indications have been stopped, and we only use it in frontline HRD-deficient or BRCA mutation carriers. And I think it's because we've seen long-term toxicities, and I'm talking specifically about toxicities. One is the effect on the ability to receive subsequent treatments, a negative impact, therefore, on overall survival. And the other is, what are the long-term toxicities, such as MDS or secondary leukemias? Now, again, in the U.S., we don't have rucaparib, but olaparib and niraparib are the most commonly used PARP inhibitors. In general, the toxicities you're well familiar with, hematologic, GI, fatigue. Some of them are agent-specific, and some are very rare, which I'll comment on. Clearly, the more common class-specific are typical nausea, GI, anemia, fatigue, generally treatable with dose reductions or dose delays. These are data from comparative studies. It's important to point out that patients that were in their control arms received placebo also had a significant amount of side effects like nausea, fatigue. So not all of that, what you see on the package inserts, are really attributable to the PARP inhibitor, as these are patients that have undergone chemotherapy or surgery. So we have to always distinguish. I think clearly anemia is standing out, but there is a higher tendency of GI toxicities and fatigue when using PARP inhibitors. Are there differences between the two PARP inhibitors? Well, there are, considering the side effects. Thrombocytopenia has been typical for niraparib. Hypertension has been typical, seen in a subset of patients. And clearly both have MDS and AML risks. Generally both well manageable. There's a very low risk of pneumonitis being associated with olaparib, but clearly manageable. This is a slide shared from Deb Armstrong, which really looks at the rate of MDS. Now, frontline treatment, the studies that Nicoletta showed you, the rate is 0.5 to 1.5%, not significantly higher than the control chemotherapy arm. But if we look at patients that have received more platinum-based chemotherapy, such as SOLO2, the rate of MDS was 8%. We know from the aerial studies that patients that have a BRCA mutation that are on a PARP inhibitor for more than 2 years, the rate goes up to 11%. So I do think this is a factor that is contributing to adverse events that are seen later when we look at overall survival for PARP inhibitors. Now let me move on to ADCs to cover that topic. We've heard a lot about it, but I want to give you the take-home message. With ADCs, we're still using chemotherapy. This is a targeted delivery of a chemotherapy, and there we have to deal with the side effects we're all familiar with, like hematologic GI and peripheral neuropathy. But new has been dealing with ocular and I think specifically pulmonary toxicity. And I'd love to pick Nicoletta's brain because we had an offline discussion about, are we overusing ADCs considering that we're still dealing with chemotherapy, and is it justified to keep a patient on continuous chemotherapy, considering some of the side effects that we're seeing with these ADCs? And I think it deserves a really balanced discussion. Ocular toxicity, we understand, it's not that scary, and there are mechanisms that are either target, on-target ocular toxicity, or the pinosotis-driven, these keratopathy, these little inclusion cysts, or direct bystander mitigation strategies like dose delays, drops, etc. They've been well outlined. Steroid eye drops are commonly used for mirvetuximab, cooling eye for other ADCs. The sentence is not ours whether steroids are really helpful or detrimental, considering increased frequency of cataracts. Europeans don't use steroids. In the U.S., we always use steroids. So I think we'll hear more data on this. But clearly, right now, close ocular examinations are necessary, lubricating eye drops. Corticosteroids, we do, but they may not be necessary. Clearly avoid any mechanical interactions. When you look at pulmonary toxicity, I think there's really neat new data to show it's either an on-target effect. Shannon mentioned folate receptor expression, but there's also an immune-mediated side effect. Many of the ADCs have an intact Fc gamma receptor that attacks macrophages, and you induce an inflammation in the lung. The other is, it's been shown that sometimes the payload can be cleaved in the environment of the tumor cells through cathepsin, which is high in many lung tissues. And there are great preclinical experiments. The higher the lung cathepsin levels are, the higher the pulmonary toxicity. So more to learn and help select patients maybe where we should not do this. Management, we talked about it. I think generally one word, proactive. Not hands-off. We have to do things in GYN like they're doing in the breast oncology world. Consider steroids early. Hold the drug early. Don't go over grade one. Really treat it more aggressively and to prevent grade 2, grade 3, and God forbid grade 4 and 5 toxicities with pulmonary toxicity. That leads us into a large topic, which would be a presentation by itself on immune-mediated, immune checkpoint inhibitor-induced toxicities. I think the take-home message is that any organ can be a target. This is a general overactivation of your immune system, and many of you have faced these, and this is a summary of the common, well-manageable side effects like fatigue, diarrhea, rash, nausea, pyrexia, but it really requires the attentiveness to say, hold it, is there something serious evolving, such as pneumonitis, hepatitis, nephritis, colitis, severe endocrinopathies, and myocarditis. These are could be theoretically lethal if not appropriately treated. These are the things we have to become sensitive and aware of when treating patients on immune checkpoint inhibitor. And lastly, what is the remedy of all of this? Well, it's putting them back on a high dose of steroids. I know Alex doesn't like hearing this, but but clearly standard for immune therapy-mediated toxicities are appropriate doses of up to 1 milligram per kilogram prednisone. Be on treatment for 4 weeks and then do a gradual taper. The problem is too early withdrawal can lead to a rebound, and consider the standard, you know, antibiotic prophylactic treatments. And that really concludes a brief review, and I'll give it back to Shannon.
Great job. So that was incredible. We have just 1 or 2 minutes, and we did get some a question from the audience.
Just a little.
So I would love to hear, maybe from Alex to start, or maybe everyone can pipe in, any thoughts on combining the two of the B96 and the relacorilant nab-paclitaxel? So the questioner is saying that there may be some benefit to minimizing steroids in patients on IO, and could there be synergy with a big mix? What do you think, Alex?
Certainly, there is going to be looking at combining relacorilant with some type of IO-containing regimen in the near future. There is no doubt about it. I don't know whether it will be pembrolizumab or some other IO, but based on the efficacy we saw in the ROSELLA trial, we are going to be certainly looking very closely at that. I think it's worth looking at.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, I just want to, again, if everyone can just thank our esteemed faculty, what a wonderful job they did. And yeah, awesome. And of course, many thanks to the contributing faculty who brought us those very interesting and relevant cases and questions. And of course, thank you to all of you. Have a great SGO.
Thank you, Shannon.
Thank you, Shannon.